And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Today my guests are Peter Levitt and Jane Ann Staw. First up is Peter Levitt. Peter is the author of 8 volumes of poetry, has translated works from Chinese, Japanese, and Spanish, and is the recipient of a coveted Lannan Foundation Award in poetry. He is also a longtime student of Zen and has been leading workshops in writing, creativity, and spirituality for more than 30 years. His new book is Finger Painting on the Moon, Writing and Creativity as a Path to Freedom, published by Harmony, and we have him here in the studio. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. You come so highly recommended.
Thank you.
And your book is a wonderful book. I wonder if you would talk a little bit about it and how you came up with the idea, because it's not only for writers, it's for people who really want more creativity in their lives, including writing, painting.
Yeah, it's true.
The arts.
I should say that I felt that, I've always felt that the creative impulse, or what we call the creative impulse and the spiritual impulse, was really one. It was just one thing that we wanted. And Allen Ginsberg wrote in a poem in 1955, yes, that's what I wanted. I always wanted to return to the body where I was born. And of course, he says, I always wanted, and he really is pointing at a kind of yearning that I don't think is just Alan's yearning. I think it's a sort of universal yearning that human beings have, not to return to the body of their mother, per se, but to return to the real body, the body of the world, or the source of life. I think we have some intuition that there is a way to that source of life. And so that's been really some way I've had of trying to understand the core of my life as well. And so I've been studying it, teaching it, working with people in that regard for so many years. And finally, I thought, let's put it down on paper and see what it is. And that's how the book came about.
So how long ago did the book start? I mean, when actually did you come up with the idea and said, this really has to be a book someday?
You know, I taught workshops in poetry in the Los Angeles area for 20 or 25 years, private workshops in addition to teaching at UCLA Extension. Mm-hmm. And every week on Wednesday night, people would show up, and I would begin with just a little something that was on my mind. And more as time developed, and I would notice that people are actually taking notes, which is really sort of shocking. Imagine taking notes in someone's living room. But they were, and the feedback I was getting from the students, and many of whom are friends of mine, was this is important not just for my writing, but for my life. And one student of many years said to me, when I come here, I feel like I'm going to church. And what she meant was that I'm going to some place that really takes me to the place I need to be spiritually and creatively in my life. And so I started actually paying attention to what can I say tonight. Mm-hmm. And that really was the genesis of the book. And at some point I thought, okay, now, without looking at any notes, what can I say that will help? Mm-hmm. And that's where the book began.
Mm. I read somewhere in the book about you choosing a life as a poet. Because mm-hmm. that was what you did. That was what you loved.
Yes.
And it's so, I think it's so unusual for writers to do that, for creative people to do that. Most of the poets I know have jobs doing something else.
Yes.
And they're writing extremely part-time.
Right.
Many of them don't teach, and mm-hmm. they're not doing workshops. They're not really doing anything but writing their poetry
right.
at night.
Mm-hmm.
How did that all happen?
I mean, actually, it was part of a painful process, because when I was a young man, I tried to find a way to fit into the culture as a young man, and hopefully as a man, just mm-hmm. just as it is. But I found that really the cultural values and the things that I cared about most really were not a good match. What I loved to do was I loved to wander. I love to walk around, and I love to hear my own mind think, and I love to hear my own heartbeat, and I love to feel the wind on my arms. That's really what I love doing. And I really couldn't find a way to make life work in some way by trying to live split, by doing that on part-time and then going out and getting a job and doing something else. And so at some point I just thought, you know, I really have got to do this. And there's no evidence really that I can be a poet or that I can be a writer. I'm not writing anything that's very good, but I love it so much I'm going to give it myself to it entirely and let's just see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a great experiment, not in writing or in poetry, but in living. And I think I really had to do it that way. Otherwise, secretly I was walking around thinking, I don't know how all these boys or men are doing it, but I seem to be missing that gene. I have the wandering around gene.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I just have to follow my genetic makeup.
Sure. Now, you translate from several different languages
Yes.
into English.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, serendipity, I suppose. My mother spoke Yiddish to me as well as English somewhat, and also she loved language. She never got to finish school, but she loved language and she loved music, and so she would just pick up stray pieces of things she heard in the street. And if she heard a Spanish word, for example, in our neighborhood, and I grew up in the East Bronx, she would say it to me and it caught my ear, and I developed a love for foreign language just through that. Yiddish to me was a mystery. I didn't feel I understood it, though in later years I discovered, gee, I know an awful lot of Yiddish. And it was, of course, connected to my love for my mother, so
mm-hmm.
I wanted to know that. But so was language. So was reading. She spent countless hours, as many mothers do, reading to me, and I was a sick child. And so the idea of mother and book and reading and language was all tied together. And when I was a young man, in school, I studied Spanish and I loved it. And so I started translating as early as 15 or 16 simple poems by Lorca, for example,
mm-hmm.
some of his simpler poems.
Sure.
And then as I got older, I met somebody and they were a Chinese scholar and I began to translate Chinese with that person. And then a little later on, I fell in love with all things Japanese and I studied Japanese speaking. And I worked with my sensei, my teacher, and so we started translating Japanese poetry together. And so it was sort of a progression. But again, the thing that was key for me was I just loved it.
Mm-hmm. I remember reading in your book how your mother would tell you stories. You would ask her
mm-hmm.
to tell you stories about when she was young.
Yes.
And I'm curious if those stories that came out of her... how instrumental they were in you becoming a writer?
I think probably they were very instrumental because they really captured my imagination. In fact, I start the book with first chapter is called Starting in Silence, and it's a rich phrase for me because not only do many spiritual traditions say that there was a great silence at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
what I call the beginning before the beginning, so the time before creation, but also I think most artists, whether we're writers or painters or musicians or composers or dancers, there is a sort of great silent well out of which our creations come. And I think all creation actually really does come from that great silence, which in the mystical Jewish tradition, for example, the first letter of the alphabet of Aleph makes a silent sound.
Hmm.
It's silence itself. And in that tradition, it is said that all possible articulation comes from the body of silence that Aleph expresses. And so out of this sort of sense of silence that my mother gave me, because she would get very quiet before she spoke, and I would be lying in bed, and in that silence, I could hear her imagination going to the beginning of something. I could feel it. And then she would speak. And I wanted that.
Yeah.
Again, I wanted that. I wanted to enter into the great silence in my own little way. And I think that all people do want it. And I think that's what the creation of art in many ways is about.
Interesting. Will you read to us?
Yeah, should I? Maybe I'll read from there.
Yeah, read from there. And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here today with Peter Levitt, author of Finger Painting on the Moon, Writing and Creativity as a Path to Freedom, published by Harmony Books. And Peter's about to read.
So this is the beginning of the chapter, Starting in Silence. When I was very young, I would ask my mother to tell me stories about her own childhood. More often than not, I would already be in bed with the lights turned out and the warmth of my mother beside me filling the room. I loved to imagine her life, to hear her say the simple phrases that brought before my eyes the mythic landscape of what came before me. I loved to hear about the trolley car, the iceman, the milk buckets. It made me laugh against all reason to imagine my mother as a young girl shoveling coal, but it frightened me to picture her standing alone in a dark tenement hallway where she washed dishes at the sink that five families shared. Each of the phrases she used called deeply to my imagination and took on the power of a constellation in the sky of my childhood dreams. Milk bucket stood beside Iceman. Trolley car was coming to take him home. And I was there too, with my mother at my side, taking in the nighttime mystery of where I came from and what the world was like before I was born. One part of this ritual that I most remember was my mother's silence. Before she spoke, she would always sit quietly for a few moments on the edge of my bed. I could hear in the dark the slightest trace of her breathing. There was something special about this, something almost prayerful in the way she returned to her own beginnings and allowed the images she would speak to fill her eyes and imagination. I could feel her do this, and it made the silence in the room feel almost holy. It was a silence filled with a curious kind of yearning, a silence made of memory, of wonder, and because she always told me true stories, it was also a silence made of pain. Life is big, it told me, very big. This is something you will come to understand. And then she would begin to speak. People have always sought the story of their beginning. It is a primordial yearning at the root of all creation myths. As individuals and cultures, we've been fascinated with the nature of how we and the world came to be. It is a primary source of our expressive arts. Once our intuition finds its way into form, we begin the naming by which we place ourselves among all other things in the world, what native people of the First Nation call all my relations. Our creations provide a sense of order and meaning that assures us and those who see our work that we do not face our lives alone. What I was able to feel in my mother's silence is true. Life is big. It is bigger than we fully understand. This is part of why we seek to hear and tell stories that take us to our source. We yearn for the intimacy of being wrapped in the sacred shawl such stories provide. And no matter what part of the world or what tradition the story comes from, we can tell when it is true.
Thank you. That was Peter Levitt reading from Finger Painting on the Moon, Writing and Creativity as a Path to Freedom, published by Harmony Books. Do you read your work aloud as you're writing? Is the nonfiction especially? I would imagine poetry.
I do. Well, it's very curious. In poetry, at some point, I began to... I made a rule, don't sell the work to myself. Don't try to make it better than it is. And so I would always read my poetry out loud in a quiet, uninflected voice. And when I would do that, I could hear the places where the rhythm was off or the sound was off or where I didn't really mean what I had written. I would become a little sick inside when I would hit one of those moments.
Yeah.
And it's because I wasn't trying to convince myself it was anything. I was just receiving it as if I had never heard it before. I did the same with Finger Painting on the Moon in particular. I read it quietly to myself, and I would listen inside. I would listen to the words, of course, but what I was really listening for was the authenticity and whether or not it was drawing a straight line between... what I really wanted to say and what was actually getting said. And so I did read it out loud to myself.
I'm curious what the process was once you... Well, first of all, I wanted to ask you, did you sell this book in a traditional way with a book proposal?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I had a notion for the book, and at first, I mean, this is sort of interesting because I had to be flexible. My first idea for the book actually was a smaller book. It was going to be a book that was focusing just on mystical Jewish teachings, but my reading in spiritual traditions and what I've learned from so many traditions was really a lot broader than that. And I tried to sell the book a number of years ago first as just that, a book on writing from mystical Jewish themes and symbols. And it was called Starting in Silence, not surprisingly. It didn't sell. But what came back was, this fellow is really a good writer, and we love his imagination. They were very kind. but we need a broader book. It was a marketing decision.
Sure.
And so I went away, and I just forgot about it for a couple of years. And then I really wanted to go back and write this book, and I wanted to write it based on the teaching, because in the meanwhile, I had been meeting every Wednesday night and doing this teaching,
right.
And I was starting to get excited about it. So I reconfigured the idea for the book and told my agent about it, and she said, oh, I can sell that book. And she
now,
did.
Was
she
this
sold
the same
it
agent?
Different
from
agent, yes.
Different agent.
Yes, I told her about it, and she said, I can sell the book. And in fact, this was one of those fortunate things. The book sold very quickly.
Mm-hmm. It's excellent. Before I forget, will you talk about where you're going to be this weekend? You're
going to
be here in the area.
Yes, I'm going
program.
To be at Golden.
Golden West.
West
College.
College. Thank you.
In Huntington Beach.
In Huntington Beach. Yes, Mafandwi Kaiser runs a series there. Her group is called Tibot Bach, and I'll be there at 8:00 tomorrow night doing a special evening. I'll read from the book, and then also I'll do some writing exercise with people. So if you come, bring your pencils and your pens and your paper. And
excellent. Okay, so you sell the book, and I imagine you hadn't really written the whole book to this length. It had been
I mean, actually, I had written one chapter and a proposal saying why this book would be just a wonderful book and how many people would want it.
Right.
And I didn't really know much about the book, except that I was going to root it in the kinds of things that had interested me all these years and that I had been teaching. And it was very curious. I decided right at the beginning that I would not write it with an outline, that in fact I was going to make the writing of this book an absolutely authentic act of discovery, just as I did with poetry, because that is in fact what I knew how to do. I knew how, as William Carlos Williams said, the poet thinks with the poem, and that in itself is the profundity.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, let's see, can I do it with a nonfiction book? Can I really push the boundary that far? And so it sounds very confident, but I was a little nervous, and so I moved 200 books into my studio so I could refer to them. But the truth, Barbara, is that I didn't open those books. I went into the studio each day, and I just began. And if I had written the day before, I continued from where I was. I would go back and read what I'd written the day before, and I would allow myself to be propelled forward by my excitement about what I was talking about or what I was being given to write by the imagination. And that's really how the book came about. It came about without plan. It came about without structure. I simply wrote what I was most interested in. The only task I gave myself was, I sort of was a good math student, one paragraph a day. That's it. I figured it out. If I write one paragraph a day, at the end of the year I'll have a book.
Mm-hmm.
And because, of course, if I write one paragraph, I thought, and I like it, there's nothing is going to keep me from writing another paragraph, but I don't have to. And so I was very gentle with myself in developing a sort of process for writing, because I had never written anything of this length before being a poet. And that seemed to work. It said to my imagination, give me just enough for today, and you can trust me with it. I'll take it seriously. And that's what happened. And so I entered into a really protracted love affair over the course of the year with my own process and my own imagination. And the result was, at the end of the year, sure enough, there was a book.
So then you give it to your editor at Harmony.
Right.
And what happened then? What sort of revision process or editing process did you have to go through?
Well,
and did you enjoy it?
Well, I did enjoy it. I mean, I remember Carolyn C. said once in conversation that she never met an editor who didn't make her book better.
Right.
And so I thought, well, if she can say that, then I can certainly just be very open to what's being given to me. And I liked my editor tremendously. Linda Lowenthal at Harmony Books. She was the executive editor there, and I was fortunate that she bought the book. What she did simply is she went through it, and she had a very iconoclastic style. She would write in the margins next to sections, chills, or ooh, or tears, or you said this already, or we know already. And she was very direct and very visceral in her reading, which was very useful to me, because I'm very visceral in the way I live and in the way I write as well. And so I understood, God, she's saying I said it already. Now I have to go back and find out where I said it and how I said it.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it that I want to say that's new here? And so it really helped me. Then once that was done, of course, then we went forward with the whole process. That's the usual process.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the rewriting or the reworking of the book. And I feel I was in the hands of such a good editor. And then it was a sort of devastating moment, but the day my final manuscript arrived on her desk, she moved on to another job. And I was given a new editor. And that was terrifying. In the business, it's called being orphaned.
Right.
And let me tell you, it felt, I mean, I shouldn't say this lightly. I don't know what it feels like to be orphaned, but I know that I wasn't happy about it. But the new editor, who was swamped, really swamped, when she sat down with my book, she really got it. And she was very, very respectful of the work that had been done and very good. And I think that she helped the book become even better. So I had two good editors.
That's excellent.
For the book. I think I was pretty fortunate. It could have gone the other way, you know. I could have had one that liked it and one didn't, and I'd just be tearing what's left of my hair out.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few more minutes here with Peter Levitt, although I think he's going to stay with us into the next half with our next guest. But he's author of Finger Painting on the Moon. And before we close out, I want to get back to poetry, and I wonder if you could talk for a couple of minutes about why poetry matters, why poetry is important to non-poets, why, whether you're working on fiction or journalism or whatever it might be, why it's important to at least read it, even if you have no interest in ever writing it.
Well, I mean, there's no good reason to write poetry. If you find yourself writing poetry, it's because you have to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a primary impulse in a human being. It's very important. I mean, for those of us who are poets and who write poetry, you know, they say if you write poetry when you're 20, it's because you're 20. And if you're writing poetry when you're 40, it's because you're a poet. In other words, you can't resist. You can't not do it. And so when someone is giving themselves to something with that sort of powerful motivation or that sort of powerful impulse toward creation, what comes out, I think, is as good a mirror of human life, not just of individual's life, but of many people's lives, as we're going to find. And I think that's why people go to art. You know, when a poet is really working, when she's really or he's really down in the work, discovering who and what they are in the moment of writing, they're having a kind of act of recognition where you know again, recognition, where mm-hmm. you think again, or you mm-hmm. know again what you've always known, but you didn't know you knew it until you wrote those words that are right before you. And that's a sort of what they call it, an aha moment or moment of some sort of revelation. When someone reads that, the chances that they too will have a sort of act of recognition and they will know again something that they may have forgotten or didn't know that they knew is very prominent. It's a very great possibility. And so I think that people who have no intention of writing poetry, if they give themselves to the poem, and that's the key, you know, you have to give yourself to the poem, and then the poem will give you back to yourself in a way. It's a very important thing to do.
Hmm.
I mean, we're surrounded by such nonsense, frankly, in language, that to find a true expression of human life is very, very rare. Poets don't fool around. They're not doing it to become famous. I mean, I said to a friend, Kathy Coleman, who also another poet and a writing teacher in Los Angeles area. You know, when you're on top of the world as a poet, you're still only 1 inch off the ground. I mean, you know, it's a very small world, but it's powerful. Yeah. It's potent. You know, there was a reason the Celts put their poets at the front of their armies. It wasn't because they wanted to kill off the poets. It's because they had the ability to cast a spell in the world, and it was a spell of great power. And I think that that's what we do. So people who don't write poetry, they read it, they come under the spell of truth or authenticity or genuine expression. Very valuable, especially in a culture that so denigrates all of life with language.
Right. Well, I wish we had more time. Well, you're going to stay. You'll be with us.
I will.
Through the next
Thank
half.
Thank you for inviting me.
And if Jane doesn't show up, we'll have another half hour with you.
Okay.
And we're going to take a short break, but thank you in any case for spending this half hour with us.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
It's a wonderful book, and it's quite a visual book, too. Finger Painting on the Moon, Writing and Creativity as a Path to Freedom. I love how it feels. It's wonderful. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
And do stay tuned. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama. Darling, Rome wasn't built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI-FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Peter Levitt is still in the studio with us, fortunately. He was on the first half. He's author of Finger Painting on the Moon. And we're back with Jane Ann Staw. And I want to introduce her, but first let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California Regents. Not that anything we say here is at all subversive, but you just never know. Jane Ann Staw is up next, and she is author of Unstuck, a supportive and practical guide to working through writer's block. Jane Ann Staw has taught writing at Stanford University and the University of Iowa, and currently teaches at the UC Berkeley Extension School and the University of San Francisco MFA program in writing. A published poet with an MFA in poetry from the University of Iowa, she is author with Mary Swander of Parsnips in the Snow. She lives in Berkeley, California, and as I said, she's author of Unstuck, just published by St. Martin's Press. Hi, Jane Ann.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you doing? Talk about Unstuck and how this book came about.
Well, the reason this book and the way this book came about was that I was a very, very blocked writer in college. And I gradually overcame the block and at some point during my life realized that I was no longer blocked and that I wanted to help other people who were struggling with writing. And so I started thinking about what had helped me along the way, and I began working with blocked writers, and at a certain point I felt that maybe I knew enough to write a book that would help more people than just those people I was working with one-on-one.
Sure. Now, when you were blocked, were you writing poetry, or what were you working on?
Well, poor me, I was blocked just as an, you know, when I went to college as an undergraduate, so I was totally blocked writing all my term papers.
Uh-huh.
I struggled terribly. So I, you know, that was, my poetry came later, and that was actually part of my unblocking.
Some would say that writer's block is a form of procrastination. What do you say it is?
I would say that procrastination is a symptom of writer's block.
Uh-huh.
I know a lot of people who have said to me, I don't really think I have block, I just put off my writing. I think it's a symptom of quite a few elements that come together. I think that some parts of block arise because we don't have realistic understanding of what the writing process is. And I think that there are also very deep emotional components to block, some of them that have been put in place when we were actually pretty young in our family of origin.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So when I know you work as a consultant as well as teaching to writers, and so when people come to you blocked, how do you deal with that?
Well, I talk to them a lot, and then I begin very slowly, trying first of all to help them begin. Often I have people who really can't sit down and write. They don't come to me unless they're so very frustrated and so much in despair that they feel desperate. So I work out ways to help people just begin to sit down to write, and it might be, for some people, it's been 5 minutes a day. And so what I do initially with that is to try to help people accumulate positive writing experiences. People who are blocked generally have a whole shipload of negative experiences around writing, and one of the most important ways of working through those is to accumulate positive experiences. So we start with trying to do that, finding ways to help the writing experience just in very short bursts become something that's pleasurable.
Mm. So what if somebody comes to you and they're on deadline and they really have something that they need to get written, whether it's a book, an article, a paper, whatever it is? Would you deal with them any differently than, say, somebody who simply wants to write and just finds that they just can't?
You're good. You ask great questions. Because that happens often. People will come to me because they've had difficulties before, and now they're really stuck and they have something important due. And so what I try to do is to explain to them that working with them on this piece that is due imminently, I can help them do that, but that's not really going to help them overcome the block or to work through the larger difficulty. So I'll work with them on what's due, and we'll try to help them feel less overwhelmed and apportion the work so that they can do, even though it's due in 3 days, I try to have them work in segments of time and find ways to reinforce themselves for doing that. But at the same time, I also require that they engage in some sort of writing that they aren't expected to be doing, even just for 10 minutes a day, just some sort of writing that will give them pleasure. And often I ask them to begin their writing sessions with that. Because if I just work with people to deadline, it really works against the kind of progress I hope they can make.
Sure. What about the blank page? You know, there's so much on the fear of the blank page, and I know personally, I love it when I have an entire draft that I have to work with, because then it means that I've gotten through the hardest part. Mm-hmm. Not everybody looks at it that way.
You know, it's really interesting. I think that writers, at least in my experience, are divided into two camps. They're the writers who are terrified of the blank page, and I'm one of those, so I'm with you. I love it when I have a draft and can start revising and fiddling, because I know that I at least have something. But there are other writers who hate revision. And so what I've learned is that people can become blocked at any point in the process. I've had clients who can write first drafts, multiple first drafts of a chapter. They can write, you know, they keep changing the chapter, but they never can come back to revise. That's where their block is. So I work with people, you know, depending upon where it is, they feel stymied, we work from there. But I think that the fear of the blank page that you and I have, what I've learned at least to do for myself, is that I keep reminding myself that what I write can be revised, and that if I at least get something down, I'll be able to come back to it at some point. And I also work with myself to write for when I'm very nervous and very anxious and faced with the prospect of a long piece and all blank pages, I will try starting with just sitting down for a half an hour and brainstorming and trying to get myself started, because I think once anybody gets something down on the page, they can begin to relax a little bit.
Are you talking about brainstorming on paper or just sitting there thinking?
No, I mean writing.
Uh-huh.
Just doing something as rudimentary as saying, I have to write this and I'm nervous, but let me just see if I have any ideas about it. It doesn't matter whether they're in any order. I'm just going to see what I know.
Yes.
And often if I can get my clients or any writer I speak to on the phone to do that for 15 minutes, even, they find that something happens, something opens up, and they begin to relax, and they can find their way onto the page.
Jane Ann, hi, it's Peter here.
Hi, Peter.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I have a question for you. I'm very interested in what you're saying, and I'm wondering, it sounds to me like you get people going right away, and you have them leap over the thing that's stopping them by taking a risk, just even in a small way. And I believe in that also. I think that once people are willing to take a risk, then it's all bets are off, because they're standing on new ground once they're able to jump there. So is that part of what's behind how you're working with people?
I think you're absolutely right, that I think writing is always a risk. And so I often tell people that. I say, you know, writing is a risk, and all people who write, all writers feel that. And it doesn't mean that it's wrong to write if it feels risky to you. A lot of people have the erroneous impression that you shouldn't sit down to write until you feel completely calm, relaxed, cool, and collected. And I try to explain that a little bit of anxiety is very normal, and that you can get through that, and that's a risk worth taking. So I completely agree with you.
Yeah, I used to tell students that the anxiety you're feeling, since we know, right, that that energy can't be created or destroyed, only transformed, right?
Exactly.
Newtonian physics. So I say that energy that you experience as anxiety is the very energy that is going to push you right through the piece. And I think it sounds like you're doing that with people. It's wonderful.
Right, but I think also that, you know, I tell them it depends on the degree of anxiety. So
yes.
I don't want them to think they have to write for an hour feeling that intensely anxious. So what I also do is ask people to watch their writing process to see if after 15 minutes they start feeling more relaxed, and then to continue writing. If they feel just tied up in knots beyond 15 minutes, I might reduce the amount of time. So what we do is try to find the degree of risk that anybody, you know, each individual can live with. And I think that's a really good point. I've never articulated it quite that way, but you've inspired me.
You
that
know,
makes a lot of sense.
Paul,
you know, we all have to risk something when we write, and we have to find what, you know, initially, if we're blocked, what degree of risk we can really tolerate.
I think we know how to risk. I think we're made to risk, actually. And Paul Klee said, I think usefully, when I paint what you know, I bore you, and when I paint what I know, I bore me,
right.
So I paint what I don't know. And I think that's the challenge for everybody, is to go in willingly and almost happily into that risk place, whether it's a minute or 5 minutes or 10 minutes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and Peter Levitt and I are talking with Jane Ann Staw, author of Unstuck, A Supportive and Practical Guide to Working Through Writer's Block. Along the lines of risking, you have a chapter called Making Your Writing World Even Safer. Will you talk a little bit more about that, about why that's important in terms, especially in terms of writing, getting unstuck?
Well, I think that a lot of people become blocked because they feel very unsafe when they write, and they misunderstand what that means, that they are taking a risk, but the kinds of risks they feel they are taking are not really the risks that are confronting them. So what I try to help people do is just make their writing situation and their writing process as safe for them as it possibly can be, so that they can feel more equipped to take the necessary risk of starting to put words on the page. So I talk about everything. It really is very individual depending upon each writer. It might be the place they write. It might be the time of day they write. It might be the kind of writing they're engaged in. I've had clients who have been writing fiction for a long time and then suddenly become blocked and can no longer write fiction. And so I will talk to them and see if perhaps shifting to a different genre will help them move through that block. So there's any number of things, and it really depends on the individual, what each of us can do to make our writing world as safe as possible.
What about, and this just occurred to me because I'm thinking of some of my students who who become stuck, and part of the stuckness sometimes seems to come from what they perceive as publishing, the publishing industry, and whether what they're writing will be accepted, or whether they will forever be writing in a vacuum where, or not exactly in a vacuum, because they have their writing, other writing students, but, you know, people who are really going for publication at some point. And rejection sometimes closes people down. And they say, well, why am I trying anyway? I just got a rejection letter. You know, what makes me think that I'm going to do anything with my writing?
Well, quite a few of the writers who come to me will voice that. But then I say, but why are you coming to me if you're thinking that what's the point? Why is it worth writing? And they say, I guess because I really can't stop writing. Mm-hmm. And yet I feel very blocked. And so I really talk to people about writing and the writing life and the components of the writing life and how it is often, you know, a solitary life. We all have to encounter rejection. Yet most of us keep writing because we can't stop writing. Even if we're blocked, we keep wanting to write. There's some people who become blocked and just disappear and, you know, change careers and transform their lives in some other way, become gardeners. For instance, in Berkeley, we have a lot of wonderful landscape gardeners who have become blocked in whatever they were doing before and then move into that setting. But there are people who want to write and can't stop themselves from wanting to write, and those are the people whom I work with. And I guess I help them to accept the fact that they are going to continue to write.
Interesting. I wanted to ask you, I always seem to get into the business aspect of writing when I do this show or any time in my life where I'm around authors. Will you talk about selling this book and how that was for you? Was that an easy process? Was it, and did you go by the traditional methods of a book proposal? And
I went by with, you know, I used a very traditional method. I have an agent. The nice thing about my agent is, though, that it was just a fluke that she became my agent. She was actually my freshman year roommate in college when I was a tormentedly blocked writer. And so it's just a fluke that we hooked up again.
Yes.
So that's kind of a wonderful reward for all of this. So I went through actually the very traditional route. She circulated among various editors, and somebody loved it. So that part of the process I was actually not very painful. If you want to talk about pain in the whole process of writing and publishing, and I don't know whether you want people
sure.
to express this on the air, but I would say that it's once the book is published that for me, that's this right now has been the most difficult period.
How so?
Well, it just took me, it totally blindsided me. I just thought once my book was out, I'd be thrilled. But I found myself in a panic. Less and less, but still some days, because my book is out there, people might not know about it. I don't know exactly what to do to help people know about it. I project all sorts of feelings onto every volume of my book that's sitting unnoticed on a bookshelf anywhere in the country. And so I've just found that part very, very difficult.
Yeah. Do you, I know a lot of authors, and I wonder if you do this, Peter. I know a lot of authors who go to Amazon every day and track their sales and see what their rating is.
Yeah. Peter, do you do that?
Yeah, I did it, but I was confused by it. I couldn't figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I asked a friend who knows about these things, and I found out that they have a system of ranking the books. For example, I did an interview on CBC Radio. I live in Canada, and all of a sudden, my book jumped. I don't know if it's up or down, but anyway, it jumped to some wonderful number. Now it was ranked 2,000 or something like that.
Good.
12 hours later, it was 30,000.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, what the heck is going on here? So I called this friend, and he said, they have some sort of internal system, and actually it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything at all. What you say is very interesting, because when you're writing the book, you're engaged, aren't you, with
exactly.
the writing of the book, and
mm-hmm.
then you have something you've never had before. You have not the the process, but you have the product.
Mm-hmm.
And now what in the world do you do with it?
Yeah, the marketing aspect.
It's dreadful. And then most publishers, of course, they give you a little bit of help, but
mm-hmm.
it's really up to you.
Right.
And you just, all of a sudden, you have to be a salesperson, and you just mm-hmm. don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you're not always as effective as a salesperson as you are as a writer or a teacher.
Right.
And so, yes, it's a whole new world.
Yeah.
But in terms of the Amazon, I became... I don't even want to tell you how many times
Did you bookmark it?
I first consulted Amazon until I realized that nothing was making any sense.
Oh,
and that,
right.
you know, it could jump a few thousand in a minute and then drop into ignominy the next day.
Yeah, absolutely right.
But I still look once in a while, I have to confess.
Oh, dear. Will you read to us?
Sure.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and Peter Levitt and I are here with Jane Ann Staw, author of Unstuck, a supportive and practical guide to working through writer's block, and she's about to read to us.
I always like to read something from the beginning of my book that describes what I felt like as a writer in college, because I think that it will give everybody who's ever had any kind of difficulty with writing hope, since now I'm a writer and I teach writing. When I think of writing as an undergraduate, I see myself alone in the lounge of 99 Brown Street my sophomore year, seated in front of my typewriter, which is set up at a card table I have dragged in from another room of the residence. All around me, in the lounge, on all three floors of the old brown shingle house I live in the dormitories on the tiny campus of Pembroke College a block away, as well as in those surrounding the quadrangle at Brown University several blocks farther, it is quiet. Everyone is sleeping, but I am awake. I sit in the tiny lounge in the skirt and sweater I dressed in that morning before breakfast, the ceiling light glaring down on me. I sit there typing and retyping, tearing sheet after sheet of paper from the roller, crumpling each one and tossing it onto the pile on the floor beside me, then sliding yet another clean sheet into the platen of my IBM electric typewriter, rolling the carriage until 1 inch of pristine paper is exposed, then poising my hands above the keyboard and preparing, once again, to type. I am trying to finish a paper due the next day. The subject of the paper doesn't matter. I might be writing an essay for my Chinese history class or a term paper for a class in religion. I might have something to turn in for philosophy or sociology, for archaeology, for psychology. And it doesn't have to be my sophomore year. It could be as early as my freshman year or as late as the end of my junior year when I became passionate about the history of religion. Despite appearances, I have not waited until the last minute to begin writing this paper. No matter when the professor assigned it, a month, 2 months before its due date, I set to work immediately, researching, outlining, researching again, writing a thesis statement, then another, and another, sitting down to put actual words on paper, typing in the first sentence, stopping, reading it aloud, frowning, pulling the page out and inserting another, typing yet another first sentence, one or two words at a time, reading the sentence from the beginning each time I stop to think, to search for a word, an expression, a spelling. This time I might complete the first sentence and move on to the next, but I will inevitably stop mid-second sentence and yank the paper out of the typewriter, throwing it in the general direction of the first. By the end of several hours, perhaps I will have one intact paragraph. That's probably enough, isn't it?
Oh, thank you. Mm. That was Jane Ann Stahl reading from Unstuck.
Jane Ann, I wanted to tell you that when I was at San Francisco State in the 60s, Herb Wildner, the novelist, was my teacher, and he gave us an assignment, and I was so frightened that I wrote a 15, and so stuck, I wrote a 15-page letter explaining why I couldn't write a 10-page paper. And he was very kind. He said, I can see the angst you're going through, and so he graded my letter.
That's what I would have done. Would you do that?
He gave me A-.
Actually, often I have people... let me back up a little. One of the things I realized when I started thinking back about my process of becoming unstuck, I realized that I could write letters easily, fluidly when I was in college, and everybody loved my letters. So I couldn't have been totally stuck. And I couldn't have been a terrible writer, even though my professors always commented upon how poorly I wrote. But my friends all loved my letters. Mm-hmm. So I realized that something more than just poor writing was going on, because for a long time I thought the reason I was blocked was that I was just a lousy writer. Mm. And often I have people who are stuck think of somebody they would like to write a letter to and write whatever they're trying to write in the form of a letter to that person. And often they find that, lo and behold, they can write the article, they can write the essay, they can write the profile as a letter to somebody when they can't do it as a piece that they envision being published in print in black and white in a magazine.
What do you think it is about the letter form?
Well, I think a lot of my block had to do with audience, and I think in letters we associate often from childhood, at least writing letters to people who like us, who view us positively. And it also seems much less formal. We're not used to being graded for our letters. Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of the audience and in terms of judgment, we don't have the negative loading that we have with college papers or pieces for creative writing classes.
Jane Ann, we're coming to the end of our time. I wonder if you would offer any advice to the writers listening who may right this very second be just mired in a writer's block.
I think what I would tell them is that what you most need to learn is to be much kinder to yourself and have compassion for your difficulties. That probably if you are stuck, if you're blocked and struggling, there might be some good reasons for it. And being nasty and punishing with yourself is the last thing you need to do and is the least helpful.
Mm, yeah, being being nasty to yourself and telling yourself how horrible you are.
Right.
Won't help things.
You're not going to get any words on the tape.
Thank you so much for coming on, Jane Ann, and continued luck with Unstuck.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You're
goodbye
welcome.
Goodbye to you and goodbye to Peter.
And goodbye to you, Jane Ann.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And Peter, thank you, too, for staying on.
Oh, my great pleasure.
It's
very interesting.
It's been a fun hour. We've just been with Jane Ann Staw, author of Unstuck, and Peter Levitt, Finger Painting on the Moon. And again, you'll be at Golden West College Friday night, 8 o'clock. In Huntington Beach with Thibaut Bach, and for a poetry workshop reading and
I'll read
some
from
good
the
fun.
Book and have people write, and we'll face some of these issues. I call them hungry ghosts, the things that want to stop us.
And if you out there need more information on where it is, email me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net, and I can put you in touch with Ms. Kaiser, who is facilitating the whole event. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, go to my website at www.writersonwriting.com, and there you can email me and tell me you want to be on my weekly email list, and I'll be happy to send you a note every week and tell you who's coming on. I'd like to leave you with a quote by Brenda Yuland, who said, "We are always afraid to start something that we want to make very good, true, and serious." And that's from her wonderful classic, If You Want to Write. Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and until next time.